Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, in the wake of two more black men being shot to death by police with thin to no justification, we'll speak with Robert Ganji of the Police Reform Organizing Project, PROP. Then we'll be joined by Carolee Coons from Crooks and Liars to discuss the FBI's entirely predictable recommendation that Hillary Clinton not face prosecution for email Ghazi and the backlash that this decision has fueled on the right. They so thought they had her this time. They really thought this one was the trick. Finally, we'll be joined by Christina Lopez. She's a researcher and reporter at Media Matters to talk about veteran Fox News personality Gretchen Carlson's lawsuit alleging that Roger Ailes, that's Fox News honcho Roger Ailes, sexually harassed her in the crudest and most grotesque possible way. But first, I want to make a couple of brief points about the horrific mass shooting at a Black Lives Matter protest in Dallas on Thursday. It was a peaceful protest. The first takeaway is that the initial reports from these kinds of breaking news stories are almost always wrong. You should take everything with a big heaping grain of salt. It's true of the cable networks and their breaking news, but even more so of social media. So I woke up on Friday to a story of multiple snipers mounting a coordinated attack on police in Dallas. By midday, or by the afternoon, it was a lone gunman, a single guy with a weapon that allowed him to fire fast enough that people thought there were multiple shooters. So, I mean, not that that makes it any less horrifying, but in a sense, it's a very different kind of situation when you have multiple people acting in coordination. That's like, that shows that there was a plot, that there was planning with different people, and they coordinated. And this is a guy who had a lot of tactical training. He was a veteran and a lot of firepower. So you think maybe these kinds of weapons that would allow a single guy to shoot a dozen people, including seven police officers, maybe these kinds of weapons should be kept out of the hands of the public, right? I mean, that seems common sense. Well, the NRA says that would violate what they call our first freedom. It's not the First Amendment, right? The founders did not think of this as our first freedom. First Amendment is the right to speak, assemble, and worship. But they say it's the first freedom because it guarantees all the others. It keeps a tyrannical government at bay. And the idea is that law-abiding citizens can confront what they perceive as a government sliding into tyranny with their firearms. That's the theory. And the senseless bloodshed in Dallas is exactly what that fantasy looks like when it plays out in the real world. That's what it looks like. Because Mika Johnson, the shooter, was a law-abiding citizen. He had no criminal record. He came from a nice middle-class background. He was a veteran. He had served his country in Afghanistan. And I guess he watched one too many videos of police, who are, of course, agents of the government, abusing or killing people. He believed that he was witnessing a government sliding into tyranny. So he confronted that tyranny, what he saw as tyranny, with an assault rifle. Now, his actions were obviously despicable and indefensible, but here's the thing. Philosophically, they were more coherent than the typical gun nuts fantasy, because at least he targeted the government agency that he felt was directly responsible for the tyranny that he was fighting against. If you look at the typical Yahoo who thinks he might use his guns to stave off big government, his beef is usually with the people who pass the laws. His beef is with, you know, bureaucrats in Washington or the courts that uphold those laws or the IRS, right? But who will he have to confront when he defies those laws that he thinks are unjust? Cops, that's who. It's the police who are going to come to his door. Think of the Bundy Ranch goofballs, right? They didn't point their weapons at the people who make land use policies at the Department of the Interior. They pointed them at the cops, whose job it is to enforce the law. Ultimately, whether you think the police are above the law, or if you think the Bureau of Land Management or the IRS is oppressing you, we have a system of checks and balances. You can get your case heard. You can go to the streets. You can protest. You can't pick up your gun and settle those grievances yourself, because that makes you a murderer or a terrorist. And that's true of Mika Johnson. It's true of sovereign citizens and oath keepers and the Bundys and all the folks at the NRA who think their dinky rifles will keep the government in check. We saw what that looked like in Dallas on Thursday, and it is not pretty. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and be right back. I want to welcome Robert Ganji back to the show. Robert is the executive director of the Police Reform Organizing Project. Robert, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I wish it weren't following the trauma of the past week.
I understand this has been a very rough week. This has been a bad and a sad time for our country.
Yeah, it is. Folks, we're recording this segment on Friday afternoon. The details out of Dallas are still sketchy. So if you're listening to the show on Saturday or Monday in West Michigan, you may have more up-to-date information than we do. Robert, your thoughts on the shootings in Dallas, Texas?
It's a terrible, terrible thing. The protest movement against the kind of thing that happened in New Orleans and in Minnesota, and the repeated fatalities, particularly of black men at the hands of police officers over the course of recent years and really over the course of the history of our country, doesn't in any way justify or even create the context where anyone should shoot and kill five police officers. No one should die when they just show up for work.
It's awful. I mean, and I would note that the Black Lives Matter protest was peaceful. The suspect who was killed, at least one of, so far, it's unclear if there was more than one, but it
right.
appears that there may have been just one shooter. He said that he is not part of any organization and acted on his own. I fear a backlash by police and police supporters. There was a report of a Trump supporter pulling a handgun on Black Lives Matter protesters in Oregon on Friday, and I really worry that we're going to see a kind of spiral of violence. Now, this incident, as you mentioned, followed the killings of two armed black men this week. We often talk about the shootings of unarmed black men, but that's not the case. Both incidents were nonetheless raised really troubling questions, and I think both have been called murders by police critics. Robert, Philando Castile was a concealed carry permit holder. Police say that people legally possessing guns must announce that fact to police when they're pulled over.
Well,
and
he,
from what we know,
he apparently did. And the, you know, the woman, his girlfriend, behaved, other people have commented on this, in a very impressive, brave, cool-headed fashion, where she essentially played back the narrative of what had happened to her boyfriend. And whether or not he was armed and whether or not the other gentleman was armed in Louisiana, it's clear from the videos or at least from the description of the circumstances that these were unjustified killings. And it doesn't just have to be police critics who are saying that. And I caught a clip of Morning Joe where the people sitting around the table who you wouldn't characterize particularly as police critics were all
right.
in agreement that this was a form of murder, and that this was a horrible, horrible thing, and that this happens far too often in our country. One of the problems with killings in Dallas is not only it's just a horrible event in and of itself, the loss of the lives of the five people, and whatever impact that's going to have on their families and their children and their community. It's that it distracts the focus away from what continues to be the ongoing problem of police in departments all over our country using excessive force and unreasonable force that leads to the death of people who were not engaged in any kind of criminal activity. I was
also struck by Castile's girlfriend's composure. This was such a horrible incident. And so at this point, what we understand was that he was producing identification.
Right.
And he said, as the law demands, that he was a concealed carry holder and was shot in front of his daughter almost instantly. So it looks like he did everything right.
Right.
Except being born white.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I think it was his mother. Someone said he was black in the wrong place. That was his crime, being black in the wrong place. And I, as dramatic as that sounds and almost as facile as that sounds, I think that's true.
Well, let's also keep in mind that he was pulled over for an allegedly broken taillight.
Right. Well, the part of the issue for us and that we emphasize at Prop, because we actually, in most of our work, do not focus on the egregious incidents. What we focus on is the day-to-day harassment and targeting of people of color. In New York City, it's done under the rubric of quota-driven broken windows policing. You know, they have tried to spin a philosophy that would justify the day-to-day practices. And the day-to-day practices, there's almost no other way that you could view them without concluding that they're blatantly racist. It's just clear NYPD officers, driven by the quota system, the pressure to make their numbers in terms of arrests and summonses, target low-income people of color. I mean, the government's own statistics bear that out. Any visit to a courtroom in New York City where you're seeing who has been brought into the courts by the cops and what they're charged with, you have to come away with the conclusion these practices are marked by a stark racial bias. And our point is that these day-to-day practices contribute to the psychology, I'm not quite sure that's the right word, on the part of many officers that black lives don't matter as much. Whatever their attitudes were when they first joined the police force, given their day-to-day experiences, given the pressure on them to arrest and ticket low-income people of color for things like driving with a broken taillight. In Eric Garner's case, for selling loose cigarettes, the man who the police officers jumped and put a chokehold on and killed in Staten Island 2 years ago. So the day-to-day practices, including things like stopping somebody for a broken taillight, contribute to the culture of disrespect and denigration that people of color experience on a regular basis at the hands of our police forces and the hands of the entire criminal justice system, really. Starts with policing, continues in the courtroom with prosecutors and judges, and then often in prison.
And I would say that, you know, what you're talking about, these routine stops, the stop and frisk problem in New York, they are related to this larger issue of police shootings in a number of ways. First of all, most simply, they increase the number of contacts between people of color and police. They stoke fear and distrust of the police in the communities that they're trying to police. So if you look at Eric Garner, he was sick of being hassled for petty, right? I mean, and so to the extent that, and I'm not blaming the victim here, I'm saying that to the extent that he was not cooperative, part of that is that he was sick and tired of being jacked up all the time.
Right. That would have been the ninth petty time, offenses. The ninth time that the police arrested him for selling loose cigarettes. And his last words, even before he says, "I can't breathe," which he says 11 times, his last words are, if you read them, they're like a cry from the heart against broken windows. I mean, he didn't use that term. And he didn't, likely didn't conceptualize that in his mind, but he was talking about broken windows. Why are you hassling me?
Yes.
Why do you keep bothering me?
You're
aren't you always, supposed to be fighting
always
crime?
Hassling me.
Right.
Yeah.
And,
always hassling.
Right. But the pressure comes from on top on police officers to do that. You know, you said the communities they're supposed to serve. Well, we don't think that, in reality, the NYPD police force is serving those communities and protecting those communities. In fact, it's the effort very much is to infiltrate, control, and suppress those communities. And again, it sounds like some, I don't know, wild-eyed leftist ideological analysis, but the day-to-day effect of that, the day-to-day effect of policing practices adds up to that reality in primarily low-income communities of color. And that's what we have to change. not only to eliminate the day-to-day abuses and discriminatory practices, but also to address this, you know, this continuing string of fatalities of people who clearly not in any way deserving of any, you know, even not even of a reprimand, and they end up dead at the hands of police officers. There are very specific things that the system should do to curb those kind of egregious incidents. But right now, the debate, even though a lot of concern is being expressed from people like Obama on down, nobody's calling for the kind of changes that have to happen if you're going to seriously address the problem.
I'm going to ask you in a minute what those measures are. I just want to point out to the audience that Robert's organization, PROP, primarily works in New York City. There are, I believe, 14,000 police agencies in the United States. They are varied in their progressiveness or lack of progressiveness. And there are some agencies that are taking steps that are ahead of the curve in taking steps in terms of retraining officers and trying to give officers additional tools in terms of conflict de-escalation. So, there are some agencies that are actually making meaningful reforms as we speak. It's something that needs to happen in every police agency, and it needs to happen in New York City. That's absolutely true. We should just mention in Baton Rouge, Alton Sterling was a homeless man. He had a gun, but it was in his pocket. He was resisting arrest, but he wasn't brandishing the gun when police shot him multiple times at point blank range. It was on video. Robert, are Second Amendment rights effectively not valid for people of color? I mean, what do you make of this one?
Well, I guess in these two cases, that's the way things turned out. But I think this is not speaking directly to the problem of abusive policing and police brutality, but we, and it's a cliche to say it, we have far too many guns in the country. And far too many police officers have guns, and far too many regular citizens have guns. And I don't know what weapons the killers used in Dallas, but it's clear that whoever were the killers, they shouldn't have had those guns. So that's, you know, that's a problem. But I want to, I hesitate to disagree with you, my host. I'm not impressed with any of the changes being made by police departments anywhere. We don't think training is going to get at the heart of the beast. We don't think body cameras, even although we think they could be helpful in certain incidents, are going to result in the fundamental reforms that are needed. We don't think teaching cops how to be more communicative or how to not panic in crisis is going to be all that helpful, although maybe isolated incidents, it may be of use. There has to be strong measures taken by government to communicate that the kind of things that have happened are no longer acceptable. We know that cops, more often than not, way more often than not, suffered no consequences, even after they killed somebody in highly questionable circumstances. The cops who killed Eric Garner, the cops who killed Tamir Rice, no consequences for those men. And so what's needed, and again, nobody in mainstream political arena is talking about this, we need independent outside prosecutors whose only job is to prosecute allegations of police abuse and misconduct, not just in cases that result in fatalities, but every alleged incident of police brutality and abuse should be the mandate of that office to investigate and to prosecute. So that the people carrying out that job would be evaluated only on the basis of whether they are effectively investigating and prosecuting police officers. That would be an agency that government could set up that wouldn't entirely eliminate the problem, but would send the message very, very clearly to police officers and to the broader public that we have finally taken steps to back up the rhetoric when we say that these killings are objectionable.
Well, I agree with everything you say, but I also believe that different training modalities and also screening for potential candidates for police academies are important parts of this story. I think that we need to approach a problem that is this severe with a multi-pronged approach, and there is no single magic bullet. We need to do all of these things. I also think that we should have police licenses. You know, it's interesting that if you look at the police officer who shot Tamir Rice,
yeah, of course,
2 seconds after pulling up, right? He
right.
had been disciplined, and basically the previous agency that had been in the process of firing him when he was hired by the Cleveland Police Department said that this guy is completely incompetent. He is not trainable. He is just a mess. And yet he was able to get another job with another police agency. And I compare this to commercial airline pilots. Robert, if you are a commercial airline pilot, who is also someone that we entrust with other people's lives, if you have, say, a couple of drinks and you lose your commercial pilot's license, you will never get another job with any other airline. We should be doing stuff like that with police agencies as well.
Yeah.
Robert Ganji, we are about out of time.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. Where can people go for more information about
Prop? They should go to our website, the Police Reform of Organizing Project.org, and we welcome volunteers. We make day-to-day, week-to-week use of volunteers in carrying out a variety of activities, both gathering information and engaging in various street actions. So join the movement to promote fundamental reforms in policing in New York and in this country.
Robert Ganji, thanks again for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for, I was pleased to be on the show.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Karoly Coons. Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by Karoly Coons. Karoly is the managing editor of Crooks and Liars. So, you know, at the end of the show, when I thank CNL for hosting us over there, I'm really thanking Karoly. Karoly Coons, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Well, hi, and thanks for having me.
So The Hill reported that five more House committees will hold hearings on the FBI's recommendation not to charge Hillary Clinton for Emailgate or Email Ghazi, whatever we're calling it. Let me begin with two quick observations and then get your take on the week's events. First, this is the least surprising outcome in the history of big dramatic announcements, right? I've always thought that Clinton's chances of being indicted for Emailgate were roughly the same as my own. At the same time, it was clearly a bad judgment call, and I'm not at all surprised that FBI Director James Comey called out the State Department and Clinton for being sloppy and having a lax security culture. Second, nothing that transpired this week is going to change anyone's mind. If you thought Hillary Clinton was a monster before Comey's press conference, then you still do. If you thought it was largely a big nothing burger, then Comey saying no reasonable prosecutor would ever bring this case just confirms that. Karoly, let's begin with your reaction to Comey's press conference itself, and then we'll dig into some of the related issues.
Well, it was very finely crafted from a political standpoint. He came out and said that she wasn't going to be indicted, which we both knew. But he left the door open for all the piranhas in Congress to go ahead and open, you know, five or six more investigations that will also go nowhere. So he gave them an entrance and, you know, some political ammunition and himself some political cover. And then, but basically said what we all knew, that there was no there there.
Yes, I agree. And piranhas is a good way to put it. Now, one reason Comey is such a large figure here is that Bill Clinton got on Attorney General Loretta Lynch's airplane at the Phoenix airport. A big brouhaha ensued. Normally, the FBI would make its recommendation privately, and then the AG's office would ultimately make the call. But because of the fallout from the Phoenix thing, Lynch had said she'll accept the recommendation of the FBI and her career staffers. Karoly, I don't think this was Bill Clinton's intent, But do you think all of this worked out for Hillary's favor in the sense that we had a Republican FBI director who had served on the Senate Whitewater Committee saying Clinton didn't break the law rather than an AG who was originally appointed as a U.S. attorney by Bill Clinton?
Well, that's an interesting thought. I hadn't really looked at it that way. I suppose you could say that it might have worked out in her favor, except for the fact that we're now going to have a zillion other investigations.
Yes.
You know, so that just means they get to keep it in the public eye that much longer, although I'm not sure how much the public even cares about this.
Yeah, that's a question that I think that has been dogging me. We know that it certainly affects her trustworthy ratings in the polls, but it is ultimately a process question about email, right? And we all have email, and it's hard to be passionate about somebody using the wrong email server. As far as scandals go, it's not the sexiest scandal in the world. One bright spot in all of this was watching that goofball H.A. Goodman meltdown.
I'm sorry.
It's just schadenfreude, right? I mean, like, you can't help a little bit of... But I was troubled by Sanders supporters wishing for an indictment. And I say that as a Sanders supporter. I thought that was just a sad bit of partisanship during primaries, right? People are motivated. They have motivated reasoning during the primaries very strongly. Now, the Justice Department has a long tradition of shying away from cases that might interfere with electoral politics. And that's not to say that they wouldn't charge you for murdering someone, right? But, you know, prosecutors have some discretion. They use it every day. And this bias towards staying out of electoral politics seems like a good thing to me, generally speaking. Your view?
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, I think that they should stay out of it and stay, you know, focused on executing the law, you know, and doing the right thing. So, yeah.
And a lot of people I didn't think a lot of people understood this basic principle of prosecutorial discretion. I would hear people say, oh, well, elites get off, but prosecutors use their discretion for, you know, low-level crimes as well. Prosecutorial discretion is not just something for the rich and famous. Anyway, Trey Gowdy was the first to hold a hearing, many more to come. He got in a few sound bites, but overall, I think Comey kind of ate their lunch and made them regret it. What was your take on the first of the congressional hearings?
Well, I agree. I thought Comey did a great job of, defending himself, which he shouldn't have had to do. I mean, there's an element here of intimidation, I think, when he comes out and makes what he considers to be a decision based on the law, and they haul him up in front of Congress to castigate him for 5 hours about that decision, you know. I thought he did a great job of standing his ground, of being fair, you know, not bowing to the pressure that they were putting on him. And the thing is, you know, you have to know, like, behind the scenes, there's a ton of pressure from right-wing groups and everything else. Judicial Watch, right, is the one who drove the Benghazi thing, and now they're driving the email thing. And they are pressured by all those billionaires that Bernie's talked about, right, all through his campaign.
Right.
That to get something on them. I mean, there really is, behind the scenes, a vast right-wing conspiracy. This is not made up. It is there. So, and I have the emails to prove it. So,
you know, this is really interesting. I think that you're probably the only guest that I've had who have read all of the Clinton emails that were released. Is that right?
I've not read all of them. I've read 8,000 to 10,000 of them.
Eight to ten thousand.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what you found when you read 8,000 to 10,000 Clinton emails? By the way, I don't know that I would have the patience to do that. So kudos to you for slogging through them. Give us a characterization. Like, what were there surprises? Just tell us some reactions you had.
Well, okay, so let me start with the first one, which is that I started reading the emails because I wanted to find something on her, right? That I was a hater.
Right.
I wasn't a supporter. I was a hater. So I was looking for dirt when I started going through them. And about the time I got to 5,000 or so, I realized, number one, I wasn't going to find any dirt. And number two, that she was actually a really good manager, a really good public servant, And she really cared about doing a great job. I mean, it was just, you, if anybody who is intellectually honest who read those emails could not come away from them thinking that she's this monster that she's been painted to be in the press.
So you're saying that you started off as a skeptic, a Hillary hater, as you say.
Yeah.
And you came away supporting her after reading 8 to 10,000 emails. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, the irony there just can't be missed, because it was truly a transformational thing for me to read those emails. And I thought to myself, gee, right wing, you kind of blew it here, because if anybody actually takes the interest in reading these things, they're going to come away with a completely different impression than the one you're trying to paint of her. I came away really impressed with her, really impressed.
Huh.
Yeah.
And you know, how does her, obviously you can't, it's difficult to glean somebody's personality from email, right? Emails are, they don't have enough nuance. They don't tell you your facial expressions. But how did the personality that you were able to see in those emails, how did it differ from the public image that you get of Hillary Clinton?
Well, I mean, I hear a lot about how, for example, how untrustworthy she is, right? That she's, and how conservative she is. That's the other thing, that she doesn't really care about people, that she's out there to serve billionaires and corporate America. And that wasn't what I found in the emails. I mean, I found somebody who, like, cared about little girls in, you know, other countries that needed a school, or even in this one, you know, little kids that were, I mean, when it came to children, she's totally, I mean, that's her first thing is kids. I'm just saying, that's a big deal for her. But it wasn't just kids. It was just, you know, people who needed help. And if she couldn't do it, this was what I found so interesting. Here, she's the Secretary of State. And if she couldn't get that thing done that they needed, she tried to farm it out to people who she thought could get that thing done. So it was, and she did that personally. I mean, as Secretary of State, and I mean, I just think that's something that you don't see very often in terms of somebody who's busy traveling all over the world doing all these things and yet thinking about, oh, this person needs a way to get to school, or they need to be in school and they're having these problems and, you know, I can't do anything about it, but maybe this person can help over here.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's and I did read your piece, by the way. Carolee mm-hmm. wrote a piece about this. Where can people find that piece, by the way?
It's on Blue Nation Review.
Blue Nation Review. What's the title again, so they can Google it?
I was the biggest Hillary hater on the planet until I read her emails.
And so reading that piece, I kept thinking, well, you know, the media tends to report numbers. They'll report, you know, there was 110 emails marked classified or whatever. And your piece was pretty much the only piece that I've read, at least, that, you know, where somebody went through and read the email and characterized the content of all this email, because it is rare that we get such a trove of unguarded communications from a major public figure like Hillary Clinton. So Trey Gowdy was obviously the first to hold a hearing. As I mentioned, we're going to have many more to come. Let me ask you this. Do you think that if Hillary Clinton is elected, are we going to hear about this stuff for 4 or 8 years, or are they going to figure out, okay, this isn't a winner?
Oh, I think it'll be like Benghazi. They'll flog it for everything it's worth until it's flat on the ground with no breath left in it. And they'll find something else. I mean, if we've learned nothing from the last 8 years, let's learn it for the future. It doesn't matter who, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley or whoever it is sitting in that White House, they will spend all of their time trying to tear them down however they can, rather than governing, rather than working with them. What have they done with Obama for the last 8 years?
Right. You know, it comes down to, I think, this this belief that is deeply held within Republican circles that Democratic governance is fundamentally illegitimate. They've told themselves for so many years that it's a center-right nation, that, you know, we're a republic, not a democracy, all of these kind of talking points. And at the end of the day, not only are they themselves unserious about governing, but they have the sense that it's there's something wrong with having Democrats passing laws, Democrats executing the law. It really is a deeply ingrained thing right now, and it goes beyond polarization, doesn't it?
It does. And the other part of it is that it goes to sort of their cynical view about federal government. I mean, they don't want the federal government to function because philosophically that is not their outlook. So as a result, if they can't be, you know, leveraging the power in the federal government, then what they're going to do is make sure nobody else does.
Government is the problem. It is not the solution. Once you believe that, then it makes it very easy for you to just to kind of clog up the gears. And that's what we've seen for 8 years. And I'm sure that if Hillary Clinton is elected, and I certainly hope that she is against Donald Trump, we will certainly see the same thing for the next 4 to 8 years. And one hopes that at some point something happens that breaks this kind of this logjam, this feverish opposition to government. Carol Lee Kunz, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Christina Lopez.
I hear a brother call a girl a bitch or a hoe, trying to make a sister feel low. You know all of that got to go. Now everybody knows there's exceptions to this rule. I don't be getting mad when we playing, it's cool. But don't you be calling me out my name. I bring crap to those who disrespect me like a dame. That's why I'm talking. One day I was walking down a block, I had my cut off shorts on, right? Cause it was crazy hot. I walked past these dudes when they passed me. One of them felt my booty, he was nasty. Yeah. I turned around red, somebody was catching the rat. Then the little one said,
yeah, me, bitch.
And laughed. Since he was with his boys, he tried to break fly. I punched him dead in his eyes.
Who you calling a bitch?
U-N-I-T-Y. You gotta let him know.
U-N-I-T-Y.
That's
come on,
here
we go.
Bad days at work give you an attitude and you erupt. It take it out on me, but that's about enough. You put your hands on me again, I put your ass in handcuffs. I guess I fell so deep in love, I grew dependency. I was too blind to see just how it was affecting me. All that I knew is you was all the man I had. And I was scared to let you go, even though you treated me bad. But I don't wanna see my kids see me getting beat down by daddy smacking mommy all around. You say I'm nothing without you, but I'm nothing with you. A man's don't really love you if he hits you. Yeah. This is my notice of the tool. I'm not taking it no more. I'm not your personal whore. That's not what I'm here for. Ain't nothing good don't come to you. Did you do right by me? Brother, you ain't
sitting in the bitch. U-N-I-T-Y. You
gotta let him know.
U-N-I-T-Y.
That's
come on, here we go.
Now that you saw Apache's video, I saw you wildin', acting like a fool. I peeped you out the window, jumping girls after school. But where did all of this come from? A minute ago, you was a nerd, and nobody ever heard of you. Now you a wannabe. You barely know your ABC. Please. There's plenty of people out there with triggers ready to pull it. Why you trying to jump in front of the bullet? Young lady. And real bad girls are the silent type.
Yeah.
Ain't none of this worth getting your face sliced. Cause that's what happened to your homegirl, right?
She got to wear that for life.
Who you calling a bitch?
U-N-I-T-Y.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Christina Lopez. Christina is a media researcher and a reporter for Media Matters for America. Christina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Josh.
This week, longtime Fox News host Gretchen Carlson filed a lawsuit against Fox News boss Roger Ailes, alleging sexual harassment and retaliation. I have to say that I am not surprised that a network that's made exploiting pretty blonde women into a business model is run by a gross misogynist, allegedly speaking. Christina, what does Carlson say happened?
Well, earlier this week, it was reported on Wednesday that she was filing a lawsuit with alleging sexual harassment on the part of Roger Ailes. And in the lawsuit, she chronicles different instances in which there was rampant sexism in Fox News, including some very direct, and uncomfortable moments with Roger Ailes, and other instances of sexism on screen with her co-hosts of the show that she used to co-host in the morning, Fox and Friends. She mentioned specifically Steve Doocy as someone that would undermine her and just treat her in a condescending, sexist manner.
And she brought these complaints to Roger Ailes, and allegedly his response was almost like a parody of sexual harassment, right? I mean, it was so over the top and extreme. Again, these are allegations. He said that everything would basically be smoother for her if she had a sexual relationship with him. She also said that he previously asked her to turn around to check out her posterior, et cetera, et cetera. And as you mentioned, this all started out when she complained about Steve Doocy, who is one of the dumbest people on TV, routinely sexually harassing her. Carlson, I should note, appears to have dumbed herself way down for the Fox News audience. She graduated with honors from Stanford University and studied at Oxford. I think Doocy's a legitimate moron, on the other hand. Now, Ailes denies it, right? And says that Carlson is bitter because her contract wasn't renewed, because her ratings was poor. They had given her an afternoon show.
Well, he says it's a lawsuit that comes in retaliation for the fact that her contract wasn't renewed and that her contract ended on June 23rd, so a couple weeks from today, a couple weeks ago. And according to Ailes, this is just like an offensive way of her to retaliate. And there's also reported have been letters that apparently she exchanged with Ailes earlier in her career, some dating back to 2015, where she apparently is very friendly and courteous with Ailes, exchanges pleasantries, and some people in the media are taking these letters as apparent proof that there is no way Ailes could have harassed her, and that really hurts any victim of sexual harassment, the fact that her allegations are doubted because of her exchanging pleasantries with the supposed harasser.
And with her boss, right? I mean, there's a huge power.
Exactly. You have to.
You suck and up to the boss.
Especially when it's been reported that advancing your career, if you're a woman, it's really hard when you're in Fox News. And there are many reports that have remarked on how hostile the environment is for women and how sexism is rampant. The other day, Bloomberg Politics had a video where they were documenting the different instances of just on-camera sexism that Gretchen Carlson experienced while being the co-host for Fox and Friends. So when you see that, it comes from a pattern, and this is a pattern that we at Media Matters have documented consistently, the pattern of sexism being a casual thing on camera on Fox News.
Yeah, it says something about the culture. Now, let me ask you this. You have what is inherently a he said, she said situation, but Roger Ailes said that her contract was not renewed because her ratings tanked. Was that a mistake? Does that take it out of the framework of he said, she said, and give us an objective factual claim that we consider What did her ratings look like prior to her being shown the door?
I think it's important to go back to the claims. Her claims are that she was a victim of sexual harassment. And I believe that any other data that we keep adding just distracts from the fact that there is someone that could have been a victim of sexual harassment. We don't know that. It's going to be proved. But the respect that we owe to victims of sexual harassment, doesn't matter the level, degree of seriousness, is that at least we have to believe that their allegations are true, and at least until proven. And we have to hear them out. So introducing other variables, like whether her ratings were high enough, whether it's just a retaliation, it sounds like that is Roger Ailes's strategy to distract from this very serious accusation. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's necessarily true, but until it's not proven, any other speculation about the ratings just distracts from the fact, and it's disrespectful to all victims of sexual harassment, I believe.
I agree with you in principle. What I was trying to bring out here is that, according to what I've seen reported, her ratings were actually increasing and were the best in the entire cable news industry at that time. She had the best
in daytime cable. Yes, she was doing really well.
So I mean, it seems like we can look at that claim by Roger Ailes and objectively evaluate it as false, and that
correct
cast light on the larger picture of who's being honest and
she
who's
was
not.
Bringing more viewers to that specific time. She was bringing more viewers in comparison to other networks.
That's right.
That is absolutely correct.
Now, since this happened, a number of other women have come forward to share similar experiences at Fox News. I'm not sure if any of them have been on the record. I think it was mostly anonymous because they feared retaliation. Tell us a little bit about that angle. Is this a bit like Bill Cosby's situation where one accusation leads to many more?
So this is very interesting because one accusation, what it does is that it shines a light on issues that some people probably fear retaliation on the part of the network. Now, if you see Roger Ailes' response to the accusations, you see why so many people have a reason to fear their professional prospects if they're expecting to advance their career within Fox News. So it's not surprising that no one wants to be on the record on this, because you can see how women are apparently powerless when it comes to their advancement prospects, unless they want to face the sexism these advancement prospects come with. And I do think there is a comparison to be made in that as soon as one person stands up and puts themselves out there, this can also lead to other people, you know, getting the courage and getting inspiration and speak up for themselves. It's very hard to understand how people that have been victims of sexual harassment in the workplace feel like. So you can't always blame them for not wanting to speak up, or you can't always blame them for having to be nice to the people actually harassing them. It does not disprove what they went through. So I hopefully this will definitely shine a light not only on the terrible things that Gretchen Carlson apparently has gone through, but also hopefully it will make people more aware of that this wasn't a one-off case. These accusations, regardless of whether they're proven to be true or not, these accusations can also shine a light on the rampant sexism that is characteristic of Fox News, and this is on camera. If you find you can, we have reported it and documented it for many years at Media Matters. The many instances of just trivializing just the mistreatment of women on a regular basis.
Yes. And just to add to your point, I mean, I would note that Gretchen Carlson is very well known, very prominent. And if you're a younger reporter, right, who is facing sexual harassment at Fox News, you look at how they're treating her and you say, wait a second, she's an 11-year veteran who's had, you know, hosted top rated shows. I'm just a whatever, a field reporter. How much worse would it be if I came forward? So, I mean, just adding to your point. Now, Christina, obviously liberal or progressive men can be sexist and misogynist. We have seen liberals accused of sexual harassment. But I wonder if it's, you know, you talk about how you've detailed over the years this culture. I wonder if it's worse on the conservative side, just given this whole anti-PC culture, the widespread belief that women make up these stories out of vindictiveness. I don't know if that you can actually answer this question, but do you have a sense that it's worse for women in the conservative media, given their larger political culture?
So we actually have no data. Like you said, it would be hard to say that one side or the other holds a monopoly on sexual harassment. What I do think that you can actually point to more instances of on-camera sexism, just because what you're saying, that the trivialization of things that they deem as PC run amok, and just the questioning and the skepticism that follows allegations of sexual harassment that you get in conservative media definitely add up to more environments that can be more hostile to women. And it's also important to see how they react when covering cases of rape and sexual assault. You tend to see how victims are discredited, or a lot of victim blaming, and this just from the side of straight news. They're supposed to just be telling you the news, and yet they include instances where they're blaming victims for what happened to them. And this skepticism that rape culture exists does not help create an environment in which women can feel safe in coming forward and talking about the things that they go through. So in a way, it's a culture that definitely affects matters and that permeates in a way that cannot be conducive to make women feel safe.
I should just add that there's been some talk of a rift between Roger Ailes and Fox chairman Rupert Murdoch's sons. Some people are saying that this may give them the upper hand in this long-running power struggle. That's just kind of a side effect of this much more important story. I would also urge listeners to check out Gretchen Carlson's piece about her long experience with sexual harassment. This is not new to Gretchen Carlson. She wrote that for the Huffington Post, and you can Google that. Christina Lopez, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. My pleasure.
Folks, check out Christina's work at MediaMatters.org. I'd also like to thank Robert Ganji and Carolee Coons. You can follow me on Twitter. You should follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can also write an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. Subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean. I want to thank Digby, Heather Parton for hosting the show over at her place, and Crooks and Liars, Carolee Coons again, for letting me host the show at their place. Of course, I want to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a better week than last week, which was a hellish week. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.